presumably be dismayed if they caught a glimpse of two black people on his patio, sitting on his tasteful outdoor furniture, talking urgently about a runaway's route.
"This boy? The one you after? He did what we told him. We got a message into him 4 months ago. Told him the night, told him how to do it, told him get sick. He did it."
I had more questions, but I held on to them for now. Ada was rolling now, talking fast. Word had come from the northern friends about a boy who needed to come out along with a package he was working to obtain. Payment was arranged.
"And we had the bay, see?"
"The bay?" A sharp glance. "No questions, dummy." Then she answered my question.
"Sick bay. Two girls are assigned to Western Section Worker Care on Sundays. And that night, both of them were us."
Monica Smith, age 24, and Angela Croft, age 27. Two working-class girls in starched nurses' whites, fighters in the cause, willing to take a job in a plantation, pass whatever tests they had to, get the necessary permits from the American Medical Association to do medical care on a PB population. Work down there for however long was required to earn trust, sweeten the scheduling person in HR, get on duty on the pre-appointed night.
"That boy came into worker care, puking his guts out like we told him to, and our people had him."
This time I made my question into a statement. "Must be hard to get yourself sent to the infirmary on a plantation." Ada nodded.
"Not hard getting sick. The trick is to get sick enough. They see a lot of injuries in those places. You're working with needles, band knives, you fall. You get a sleeve tangled in a drive shaft. I knew a man who had his face burned with a hot iron. They sent him down to worker care and turned him out again in an hour. Most injuries they handle in population or on the floor. They wrap you up, maybe a steroid shot, and you're back on the floor. The thing you want to get sent down, is poison. At a garment factory, you know, you're working the floor, there's a lot of industrial strength lying around. Sealants, chemicals, and cleaners. You smart, you don't overdo it, you can get yourself real bad, get it so you almost die. Then they take you down for sure."
That sent me back down, back into the tunnel, down below Indianapolis with that boy. The pallor of Kevin's skin, chemicals and cleaners, oh, that boy. That beautiful, broken boy. Not to be thought of now, work to do now. "All right, so he comes in, he's sick as hell, he's got this package." Ada winced, moved her head back and forth.
"I don't know. Some of these details I never had, you know. But the way I understand it, the package went to the driver direct. Never came into the bay. But you'd have to ask one of them nurses, which you will never be able to do. And don't ask me, by the way, what the fuck was in that envelope, 'cause I do not know. And I do not care."
So there's Jackdaw in the sick bay. The clock is ticking. The delivery is scheduled for 8:49 p.m. onto a 45-foot tractor trailer. 4,200 raw bolts for export and all the rest of it crated and palleted and headed for a route along the Red Highway. The boy is there, and somehow or other the package is too. It goes into the jacket of the driver. Maybe the driver is playing out a crush on one of those sweet young nurses, Monica or Angelina. And maybe he stops by with flowers and it's a quick thank-you hug to slip it in his pocket. Or maybe one of our nurses junks it out the window while the driver happens to be out for a stroll around the campus, stretching his legs before climbing in the rig. Ada doesn't know all that. Ada says if I want to know how the package got from the girls to the driver, I'd have to ask one of them. Which I'll never be able to do.
"You got it."
And as for Jackdaw, Jackdaw's body, precious cargo, he went out in a barrel. The trucks are loaded out in a secure area, of course, and plantation security checks and double checks every single item. They open every crate, shine their lights into every box on every pallet. You see, the good guys are smart, too. The good guys are always working, too. There's a workshop down in the Great Dismal Swamp. A Panthers-funded research center with honest-to-God engineers down there building all kinds of crazy shit, looking for those golden ticket ideas. How to slide people past all those checks and double checks. Turns out, one thing that doesn't get opened up for a final check after it's packed is medical waste. So what about a man-sized rubber bladder fitted with a thin reed like the one a scuba diver wears so a person could survive in there down in all that waste? What about you get a man to the infirmary, make it look like he burst loose and leaped out a window, and really, he's coming out in a barrel. Ada described it, and that was a feeling you could feel. A feeling that I could feel.
wrapped up tight and clammy in some kind of rubber suit folded over and jammed in a bucket entombed. Rolled end over end, helpless, banging against the sides, the darkness and the heat and the stink. And then with the poison sloshing in your guts, cleaners and chemicals, and added to the terror. The certainty as you were wheeled out of worker care toward the loading dock, capture was coming. This could not and would not work.
So that's it, Ada said. That's the hard part. Boys in the truck. Truck clears the gates, clears the Alabama border. Freedom land.
Ada clapped her hands together as if knocking dust off of them, like, mission accomplished. That's what happened? Ada looked at me sideways.
That was the plan, I'm saying. Far as I know, yes, that's what happened. We know the truck came out. We know the nurses did their part. That's what we know.
Okay, I said. Okay. But it wasn't okay, not even close. I'd learned nothing that I needed to know. Kevin leaves in a barrel and the package is in the driver's pocket. What then? Where did the boy get out of the truck?
That's not my part of it. That's the driver.
Where does the driver give him the package? How does he get the rest of the way north after he's off the truck?
You don't listen, man. I'm telling you, I don't know.
My coffee cup was empty. I stood up. I looked out at the lawn, the sunlight. It wasn't enough. It wasn't close to enough. I looked down at Ada, still sitting on the patio chair. I want to talk to the nurses.
Well, that's going to be hard, because they don't exist.
She smiled.
They never existed.
I was agitated. I was unhappy. Get to the lawyer, Bartnett said, and he will point you in the right direction. So here I was, and what did I have? The sun was slowly rolling out across the lawn, brightening the green of the grass inch by inch, closer every moment. All right, then, the driver. How do I get in touch with the driver?
I don't know.
Ada, please.
I'm telling you straight, man, I don't know. The nurses came from a guy Marlon knew, a guy from Atlanta, and the nurses got to the driver once they were already working there.
How?
Two pretty nurses, how you think? Listen, okay? I got no connect with the truck driver. I don't have a name or number. You'd have to walk into GGSI and ask.
How do I do that? She barked a laugh, looked at my face, and stopped laughing.
We help people out of these places, son. Not in.
Ada stood up. We were done. She yawned, spilled the dregs of her coffee onto the ground around one of Counselor Russell's flowering trees. And what about the girl? I said quietly. Ada waited before she answered. Waited so long that when she said,
What girl?
I knew it was a lie. Luna. This time the answer came too fast.
I don't know that name.
You do. She's the one who got hold of the package in the first place. I didn't know how, and Ada sure as hell didn't know how, but Luna had done the hard part. She was the one who got your precious evidence, Jackdaw, weeping, standing in the river. She took all the fucking risks. Ada, though, was shaking her head, setting her chin.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Sure you do. I closed my eyes, thinking of Jackdaw, of Kevin, his life flown out of him. And I think you know, I said to Ada. That she thought she was getting free.
Yeah, well,
said Ada. And it was a kind of miracle. Because even though she said she didn't know who I was talking about, and even though she said she had never heard the name before, she said,
Well, it wasn't her time.
I guess not.
Whatever promises were made to that one, they were not made by me. You understand?
Her face now was downright defiant. The face of the woman I'd seen on the square, the one who had scowled and stared while the others were beating me into the car.
Those promises were not made by me.
She went toward the door, and I followed her. And now all I could think of was Luna. I bet Kevin had told her what they had told him. I bet she had taken some poison, too, some chemical or cleaner, gotten herself sick and gotten herself taken to worker care. And then she woke to find that Jackdaw was gone, and she was still there. Left behind. The only thing worse than a lifetime of slavery. That taunting instant of hope gone in a flash. And I knew, of course, what happened to her next. When the package was discovered missing and Luna was found to have helped in its disappearance, she was tortured then, Bridget said. Tortured and killed. That piece of it from Cook. That had been the last thing for Kevin. That's what had finally done him in, hearing that, when Cook gave that sad report. She's dead, okay? She's dead. Subdued, then tortured, then killed. But that was the aftermath. Carnage in the wake. The job itself had gone off without a hitch. Tevin had gotten himself to worker care, the nurses had packed him up in a barrel of blood and gotten him onto a truck, and then they made themselves disappear. The package to the trucker. Everything as planned, so where the hell was it?
Hey, hey!
Marlin was coming out fast, crashing into Ada going in, but he was yelling at me. He took me by both my arms, sudden and fierce. Hey, do you know some fucking white girl?
Chapter 5. Marlin had been washing the lawyer's 3 old Cadillacs, pulling them out onto the driveway one at a time, keeping a lookout for lurkers, peepers, anything strange out on the street. And he'd found something. A pink South African hatchback obnoxiously visible on the sedate and moneyed suburban street, with a white girl in the front seat dozing. Down in the basement, he insisted on holding Martha at gunpoint. I said it wasn't necessary, and Ada agreed with me, but Marlin said, "We don't know what the fuck this girl is." And Shy said, very quietly about me,
"We don't even know who he is."
Which I was glad nobody heard. So we sat in an awkward arrangement around the table back down in the basement kitchen, a very different place in the morning. Last night's dishes were a precarious pile in the sink. Thin bars of sunlight found sticky patches on the concrete floor. It was me and then Martha, her knee bouncing with nervousness, her face bleary with worry or fear. Then Shy, Marlin beside Shy, opposite Martha, aiming his .45 at her while she told her story. Ada stood by the sink, arms folded, listening.
I saw these people...
Martha caught herself. "These people," she winced.
"I saw you getting beat up. I was scared."
Without her cat's eye glasses, without any drugstore knick-knack in her hair, she looked more like an adult than I was used to.
"I followed the car. I tried to be careful."
"I guess that was a stupid fucking thing to do," said Marlin.
"I guess we need to be more careful about being tailed."
That was Ada, from over by the sink. And the reproach didn't much help Marlin's mood. He hissed and leaned back, sneering, Shy very gently, laid her hand on his shoulder, and I saw it work, saw the tension ease out of his body. Love at work.
"All right,"
said Ada, impatient.
"Look,"
she pointed back and forth between Martha and me.
"You know this person?"
"Yes," pointed to me, then back to Martha.
"You trust her?"
I hesitated a half beat, and into the hesitation welled up the horror of what I was doing. It wasn't Martha I distrusted. It was myself. "Yes," I nodded. "I trust her."
"All right,"
Ada shrugged.
"You still want to go in there and find that truck driver?"
Ada was a maker of plans, a hatcher of plots. Like Father Barton, like Officer Cook, like me. She came and pulled a chair up to the table and explained what she was thinking. Martha could be of use now for the same reason she had been useful in getting me across the border, because of the color of her skin. While Ada laid it out, walked through the way it could work, I watched Martha from the corner of my eye and could tell how carefully she was listening. Her eyes, which I was used to seeing jump all over the place, were focused and intense. She was getting herself ready. The plan was crazy, risky as hell, no question about it. There were a very few things that Ada and her group could tell me about GGSI, about the layout and security arrangements of its headquarters. Most of what they knew was second-hand or third-hand, and much of it was outdated. Rumors, whispers, gossip about the inside. Of my specific questions, they could only answer a couple. Yes, we would be screened in on arrival and checked out on departure. There were cameras, yes, all over the campus, but not in the areas that were restricted to white workers only. Alabama state law forbade the surveillance of employees without cause. It occurred to me to ask if Ada knew anything about the one building whose identity I could not figure out from the overhead map in the full file. That unlabeled structure jammed in behind the Institute for Agricultural Innovation, but of course, I could not ask about it because then I would have to explain where and how I had seen such a map. We came to the end of the conversation. The plan was formed as it was going to get. And still Martha remained quiet. Her hands, too, were still, not fiddling with her rings, not tucking a lock of hair into the corner of her mouth. I had the odd sense of seeing her real self rise up out of the motionless form of her present body, like the person who had been inside the other person all along. I looked at her when the talking was done. "You don't have to do any of this," I said. "You've got your money." She turned her head slowly and looked at me.
"But what about Steubenville?"
she said, and I blinked.
"What? You don't think it'll work?" That whole crazy business with the man in Steubenville, the guy who said he can get me into that database?
Torchlight, I said. Then, no. No, I doubt it.
So?
So. I knew her expression so well. I saw what she was seeing, opportunity.
But if this plan, if her, I'm sorry, what? Ada.
Martha smiled at her.
Thank you. If Ada's idea works, and we can get in there, then don't you think there will be a way to access it directly once we're inside? Once we're in there? Isn't that right?
Right.
Right. So I can't miss that chance.
But, I started, but something in her face, in her eyes, I stopped.
I will call my sister. She will hang on to Lionel another day.
Yeah, I know. Martha, I stopped.
It's dangerous,
she said, speaking very slowly.
It is very risky, I understand, but if there is a way to find out what has happened to that man...
This was in the form of a question, but her voice had no questioning in it.
Then that is what I am going to do. I have to.
You gotta understand, though.
I know.
I can't promise anything. My protests were half-hearted. She was firm, but I could have talked her out of it. I could have told her there was some other way. I could have opened myself all the way up, torn off the blank mask and shown her my face. I could have told her to forget the whole damn thing. But this was my chance, and I knew it. I told her that if this was what she wanted, I wanted her to have it. I told her that if she helped me get in, I would try to get her what she needed. I told her that because I needed her. I had to have her. My empathy was woven, as ever, with cunning. We spent the rest of that day cosseted in the lawyer's house and with the lawyer's people, refining and fine-tuning, building our story. Shy went up and down the stairs collecting articles of clothing from the closet of the lawyer, from the closet of the lawyer's dead wife. I ended up in a peach-colored sweater and in pants of Marlin's, black pants without pockets. Yeah, that's right, he said. That's good. Trust me, man. Down here, they don't like niggas having places they can stick shit. We did not see the old man himself again, but I heard him. 3 or 4 times I heard him. From an adjoining bedroom, moaning in his sleep. Chapter 6 Thursday morning, vivid and clear. Me and Martha decked out and ready to go. Closing the doors of her sedan in the wide parking lot of garments of the greater south. Martha, showered and shining, in a sharp red professional skirt and blazer, a piece of green jewelry pinned at her breast, timeless pieces from the collection of the lawyer's long-dead wife. Martha in good old fancy white lady drag, and me in the peach sweater and pocketless pants, already wearing the servant's smile, already rolling in the bashful gate. Lifting the black rolling suitcase out of the trunk loaded with the tools of the trade. I eased the bag down onto the asphalt while Martha waited. I pulled out the handle of the suitcase. She started and I followed. I was in charge of the bag. This was the South. She glanced back and I looked up and we looked at each other just for a second. One last human look to go in on. The plantation had not been hard to find. Coming off State Route 4, we saw a big green sign, a dedicated exit. As for a university or military base or theme park, the exit sign went so far as to proclaim the company motto, American grown, southern sewn, along with the logo I had seen previously on Jackdaw's collarbone, the proud uppercase G with the other letters tucked safely inside. The logo that was supposedly waiting for me somewhere in the endless south, emblazoned on that envelope, the needle in the haystack I was going to find. That same logo was on each of the three buildings that together formed GGSI headquarters. Three glass-walled skyscrapers standing lordly above the parking lot, blinking back the sun. The logo was on one of the flags flapping above the concrete plaza in front of the buildings. There were three altogether. One flag for the company, one for the state, and one for the United States of America. Flags and recessed concrete and a handsome fountain. There was a statue. A giant abstract bronze, rounded and swooping, which as you got closer, turned out not to be abstract at all. It was a bowl. A simple bowl made heroic. A cotton bowl like a triumphal arch. I had seen corporate plazas. Corporate plazas in Manhattan, in Boston, in Washington, D.C. This was no different. Exactly the same. I held tightly to the grip of the rolling suitcase. I came up alongside Martha, but her sunglasses were on. Her human eyes were hidden now. She stopped just outside the door of the center building, and I rushed past her to open it. She walked past me and did not say thank you. Deep in her character, ready to go. The lobby was vault-like and chilly after the early autumn warmth of the parking lot. The words Garments of the Greater South Incorporated were 6 feet high on the back wall, cotton-white letters on a wall of blue sky blue, alongside a gigantic photo montage of happy Asian children kicking soccer balls, turning cartwheels, shouldering their sturdy backpacks and their brightly colored cotton clothes.
Yes.
The receptionist was waiting at a desk big as a spaceship between two banks of elevators. Red lipstick, blonde hair, blue eyes, a tasteful gold necklace.
How can I help y'all?
I ducked my head while Martha smiled.
How are you this morning? My name is Miss Jane Reynolds from Peachtree Management Systems. I am here to see Mr. Matthew Newell.
Okay,
said the woman behind the big semicircular desk, lingering on the K, teasing the word out into a question while she typed, pulling up a calendar.
And did you have an appointment?
Well, yes and no,
said Martha, and my head was still down, eyes down. But I could hear in her voice that she winked as she said it.
We met down at the CSO back in June, and Matthew, Mr. Newell, he was sweet enough to say that if I was ever in the area, I should feel free to stop by.
Oh, said the blonde. I see.
CSO was the Conference of Slaveholding Organizations. It was a safe bet that a plantation the size of GGSI would have sent a sizable contingent. It was an open question whether Matthew R. Newell, Assistant Vice President of Transport Operations, would have been among them. We were out on the wire here, me and Martha, out here together.
So, would you mind just ringing him up, see if he's around?
Of course I should have called first. I just had an appointment right down in Blessing, and I thought...
The blonde was already in motion, offering Martha an empty smile and a wait-just-a-moment forefinger. She tucked the telephone receiver under her ear and pressed a button on her console. The elevator doors opened on the far side of the lobby, but no one got out. We had gone over everything on the way, discussed every detail, various contingencies and possibilities, but Martha was in charge now. She would have to be. My job was to walk with my eyes pointed downward at about 45 degrees. My job was to smile and keep smiling. There was no security in the lobby. No powerfully built men with keen eyes and bulges at their hips. Probably a panic button under the woman's desk or a panic switch at her feet. Maybe a gun down there, too. And there were cameras, unhidden. One above the reception desk, angled down. One above each bank of elevators. Cameras in the public spaces, Ada had said, but not in the private areas. Not in the executive offices. That was as far as she knew. That was according to the latest reckoning. We were counting on it, but we didn't know. The receptionist cupped one palm over the mouthpiece.
Excuse me, hi. Where did you say you were from again?
Peachtree, ma'am, I said. Peachtree Management Systems.
We're consultants, said Martha,
flicking an irritated look at me, servant speaking out of turn.
Workplace efficiency, but, like I said, it's as much a personal call as anything. I just wanted to say hi.
I pressed my hands together while the blonde said, a couple more times and went back to murmuring into her phone. I stood and waited and grinned and looked at the floor, fighting back against the simple, sick, vertiginous awareness of where I was, where exactly. I was tottering on the rim of it. Through those doors, up those elevators, behind these three towers. I was breathing very slowly. Martha stared into the expanse of the lobby, and I could not guess what she was thinking. We were deep in character, and I'd taken us into this place. And I could feel the terrible weight of it pressing my flesh, and when the receptionist looked up again and smiled, her red-lipped smile was the wide, burning grin of the devil.
You're in luck,
she said to Martha.
He is here, and he'll be right out.
Oh, isn't that nice,
said Martha.
That's just perfect.
Yes,
she sniffed.
Your Negro will need to be cleared.
Again, as at the border, scalp and armpits, teeth and tongue, pants down, shirt up. They had a room for it just off the lobby, and an attendant, a tired-looking free black man who scowled and said nothing as he ran his clumsy fingers over my body. I stood absolutely still. I held my arms out. It would have been the school at Bell's the first time, the first of such searches I had endured in my life. Lesson one. Your body is not your own. This place, this plantation, was on a different order from Bell's. Physical size and scope of work. A different universe of slavery from the little 36 acres where I'd been raised.
Green grass, farm county, pig lots, cattle pens, silos. The world I was about to enter was a 24-hour operation, ultra-modern and ultra-efficient, with computerized inventory tracking and comprehensive worker control protocols. There was a camera in the upper left corner of the room bearing cold witness to the man and me. I was here and I was there at the same time, feeling this tired guard's hands on my chest at the same time as I was feeling the rough hands of the guards at Bell's a lifetime ago. This is so much worse, I thought, and immediately thought, no, no, nothing could be worse. But it's a waste anyway, isn't it? The idea of comparison just in general, holding up one kind of horror against another. All right, the bored security man broke his silence, straightening up, pulling off his gloves and chucking them into a bin. Bag now. Quickly he opened the rolling suitcase I was hauling, rifled through that, too. A change of clothes for Martha, change of shoes, and the laptop turned off, which he opened and closed uninterestedly. Okay, he said, you're clear. But then, before I could lower my arm, he wrapped something around the wrist. A thin strip of paper, bright green, which secured to itself, tight as hell, tugging at the small hairs of my arm. That is an identification bracelet, said the man. That identifies you as a person bound to labor and a member of our staff. Whoa, I said, whoa, whoa. Don't worry, you'll come back through here again on your egress from this facility. But every dark-skinned person is required to wear a band while on the grounds. He showed me his own bracelet, which was a cool red. But don't you have a color for folks like me? Negroes like me, just here for a visit? No, man, we don't. His voice was dry, humorless. We don't actually get too many of those. Martha was waiting for me in the lobby, laughing with her hand on the arm of a short, fat white man in a sport jacket who was laughing too. This was Newell, instantly recognizable from his picture on the company website, where we'd found him yesterday afternoon on an old laptop belonging to the lawyer's people, making our plan. It was Martha who pointed to him, to his weak chin, sappy, smiling headshot, his sad-sounding title and anemic history within the company. There's the guy. There's the guy we want. And now here he was, the guy we wanted, dumpy and thin-haired and pink-cheeked in casual slacks and polished shoes, with one of Martha's hands on his forearm, both of them laughing like old pals.
Well, of course I do,
Maddie Newell said hopefully.
You're not the kind of gal a fellow's gonna go and forget.
I do like to think so,
said Martha, her laugh a tinkling falsehood.
I surely do.
You caught me in a good mood, too, I must say. A good week for us. Darn good week.
My mind jumped to Donatella Batlish, to the footage from the motel TV. The woman flying forward suddenly with the gun blast, collapsing, limp. Good news for the Southern Interest. Happy days at GGSI, but no. No, Newell just meant the late frost.
We're coming up on Halloween, and here we still got acreage coming into flower. Don't see that every year. No, ma'am.
And for a second, as I approached them across the lobby, my fake smile was real. A smile of appreciation from Martha. I watched her nod admiringly. I watched her touching Newell's elbow. Jesus. She was a natural.
Oh, Mr. Newell.
Please. Please, Jane. Make it Maddie.
All right, then. Maddie.
She made it sound like Hercules. He beamed.
Maddie, this is my associate.
Newell peered at me, confusion in his small eyes. He had a lanyard around his neck, dangling an ID card in a plastic sheath. His face was soft, his hairline retreating just as it was in the picture. Since sitting for the corporate headshot, though, he'd grown one of those little Tommy Jefferson ponytails, and it didn't particularly suit him.
You're a associate?
Associate. Assistant.
She winked at him, mouthed the word servant.
Whatever you want to call it. He does what he's told.
Maddie sized me up, smiling weakly.
Just seems like...
He shrugged.
Well, funny work for a nigger.
Grin, 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 smile, smile, smile.
Oh, I know, sir. I know.
I glanced at Martha and Mrs. Jane Reynolds, making sure it was okay to talk.
I guess I'm a funny kind of nigger.
Maddie Newell gaped for a second, then laughed, a nervous, throaty chortle, shaking his head at this strange old world of ours. The flag snapped sharply outside in the brisk wind. The Asian children in the photo montages were frozen in their happy cartwheels.
Well, come on up to the top floor, said Newell. Have a good look at the joint. Then we can talk about whatever it is y'all are selling.
The whole building had that same pleasing color scheme, easy white and gentle blue, and every wall was lined with more of the glossy enlarged pictures. On the way to the elevator was a housewife of some indeterminate Southeast Asian ethnicity reaching into her closet for a stack of towels, while reaching through the closet wall from the other side was a black slave grinning, servile and unseen, as he provided the stack of sturdy cotton towels. I did not blanch. I did not slow. I walked past, sticking close behind Martha, noticing things. I noticed the pattern of the light fixtures in the long hallway. A bank of two, then a bank of three, two and then three. I noticed the pants of the slaves in the photographs, black like Marlon's pants, like the ones I was wearing along with my inoffensive peach sweater. I noticed the lushness of the white carpet. I noticed everything. The elevator raced us soundlessly upward fast enough for my ears to pop, and I stood clenching and unclenching my jaw, standing in quiet self-erasure at the rear of the car. I looked anywhere but up at the camera mounted in the high corner of the elevator. I studied the button plate on the elevator doors. Murdoch Elevators, it said. Murdoch, Louisiana. Martha laughed and flirted with Mr. Newell.
No, sir,
she was saying.
Oh, no. We're up from the Birmingham office, but the company is headquartered in Georgia.
Georgia, huh?
Said Newell.
And how are things in the state of surrender?
Oh, stop,
she said and slapped him on the arm. He laughed, eyed her nervously, hoping not to have offended, and rushed to reassure her.
I'm only teasing, of course. Bygones be bygones and all that. Every state free to choose its own path. The American way.
While Newell mouthed these wooden platitudes, I had another quick flash of Batlish flying forward, arms out, the panic of the crowd. I wondered what Martha was thinking about. The elevator dinged, and we stepped directly out into sunlight. The whole top floor was taken up by one room with windows for walls, the sun streaming in gloriously on a bright open penthouse with marble floors.
This is my office, said Mr. Newell, and immediately snorted and waved his hands. Just kidding, of course. This is the observation deck, what we call the perch. I love taking folks up here. This gives a real strong sense of the place.
He walked up to the glass and gestured for us to follow. Well, for Martha to follow. My presence he had more or less forgotten. I was the rolling suitcase. I did what I was told. I was not worth thinking of. He stood at Martha's elbow.
Really something, huh?
It sure is.
From inside my cloak of invisibility, I looked too. Most of the buildings were like the ones we were in, made of glass, beaming and winking at each other across wide green lawns. The buildings were gathered in clusters, divided into regions separated by winding walkways and black-paved service roads and high chain-link fences. I was in both places at once. I was back there in the Capital City Crossroads Hotel, staring at the satellite image from the full file. And I was here for real, on this plantation, in the presence of the real thing. Everything getting realer and realer the closer you get to it, like flesh on bones. I got busy correlating, matching up the buildings I was looking at with the blurry images I'd seen in the file. The offices, the outbuildings, the shipping and receiving center, the machine shop, the five brick towers of the population center gathered around a tall tower with a glass cupola. My mind saw that something was missing before I knew what it was. Where were all the people? At Bell's, the yards were always full of us, hustling and hollering, singing sometimes, yelling at each other or getting yelled at by the guards and the working whites. Down there on the green lawn of DGSI, I saw not a soul. Everybody inside, I figured. Shift in progress, slaving away, and yet...
Now, okay, so those right there are the garment factories,
said Maddie Newell, pointing down at industrial buildings as big as football stadiums, scaffolded with exterior piping and drums, sending up streams of dark smoke.
That right there is kind of the heart of the place.
Newell was looking down at the pristine lawn and the handsome facilities with clear satisfaction, giving us his overhead tour with almost proprietary pride, as though GGSI belonged to him instead of the other way around.
Inside there are the ginning operations, Newell added, the cleaners and the dryers and so on. We've got the largest set of high-capacity round-based cotton gins in the state.
Well, I'll be,
said Martha.
No kidding.
My eye, meanwhile, had found it, that one abstract rectangle shaded by the Institute for Agricultural Innovation, the small, dark building that bore no number or name on the aerial picture. I couldn't ask Newell what it was, of course. I couldn't ask Martha to ask. I was black. I wasn't there.
Now, this is a 24-hour-a-day operation, just by the way,
Newell was saying, Martha still nodding, eyes big with amazement.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We run in shifts here. Morning, afternoon, night, and late night. Never a dull moment. Sabbath comes every day for 1/7 of the population, so we never have to stop the plants. We got 7 Easters, too. 7 Christmases. Only thing shuts us down is a bad accident, and...
He made a fist and knocked gently, ha-ha, on his bald forehead.
None of those in 29 months.
He grinned nice and broad and gave me a wink.
None of your cousins got a thing to complain about down here, son, and I mean it.
It seemed he wanted me to respond, so I responded.
I bet you're right, Mr. Newell. I bet you're right.
Newell laughed nervously inside his throat.
I mean it, son. This is not the slavery of 50 or even 10 years ago. People think about slavery and they still think, still, about the whips and the dogs and the spiky neck chains, all that nasty business. But this is now. This is the 21st century. You see there?
Pointing again with that fat finger, a gold ring between the second and third knuckles, forcing me to look.
That there is the population center. 4,000 head in those buildings right there. We got a rec center in there, gymnasium equipment that every one of our team members is not just encouraged, but also required to use. And you see that building in the center with the turret-looking thing on the top? From up in there, the guards can see into every single cell, and every single cell can see the guards, too. So everybody knows they're safe. Everybody's looking after each other. That goes back to Jefferson, by the way, that design. So you're looking at a proud tradition here.
He had fixed his hand on my arm all of a sudden, tight and congenial, like a fraternity brother.
Forget about whips, okay? Forget about tasers. The BLP allows it. You probably know that. But I can tell you, because I know the folks down on the 6th floor, I can tell you that we do not use tasers here. Once in a blue moon, maybe, is it thought to be necessary, because this here is an incentive-based facility, okay?
His fingers were tight as a shackle on my bicep.
And I tell you, you hear folks saying, what do they feed those poor boys? Then I go home on meatloaf night at my house, I'm thinking, gee, I wish I was over in the mess hall with the peeves,
he snorted.
I only wish. Just don't go telling my wife.
I laughed, good and loud. Come on, Victor, come on, brother. Get it done. Find this fool trucker, find out what happened to that envelope. Bring the damn thing home, that was all I had to do. I laughed and laughed. Newell, encouraged by my laughter, in full booster mode, turned his attention back to Martha.
Can I tell you something crazy?
He leaned in toward her earnestly.
If garments of the greater South were its own country, we would have a gross domestic product bigger than that of Rhode Island.
He leaned back, goggle-eyed, red-faced.
Now, ain't that a hell of a thing?
It sure is, said Martha.
It sure is.
One thing that you could see from up here that hadn't been included in the satellite imagery from the full file were the cotton fields themselves, the unending acres of them rolling out from the campus in all directions like the moonscape beyond a space station. And I could not see them, not from this height. But I knew they were out there, hundreds of persons bound to labor too small to be seen, lost in among the long white lines of cotton. For a second or two, I stared out into those distant fields, stared at the fact that when this was over, once I talked to that driver and he pointed me to the next place I had to go, I would walk out of here, and those people I could not see but knew to be suffering, they would all be here forever. What do you do with that fact? Do you hold it like a stone in your hand, pitch it away from this great height and watch it fall? Do you swallow it and feel it in your throat till the day you die? The elevator dinged.
All right now,
said Newell.
Let's head on down.
Martha really was a goddamn natural. We filed into Maddie Newell's small office on the 14th floor, past a hallway of air conditioner chill and the faint smell of coffee. The three of us crowded in there with the filing cabinets and his smooth black desk and computer. She and I had practiced it, going around and around back and forth in the lawyer's basement, and as soon as Newell closed his door behind us, away she went, off to the races.
Well, as long as we're here visiting,
she said, and he grinned, gave her a tisk-tisk.
Here it comes, huh? Here comes the sales pitch.
Martha winked.
You caught me. It'll be painless, Matthew. I promise it will.
Maddie.
Maddie. All I want to do is ask you a simple question.
All right.
His brows were knitted. His fingers were laced together. I could read his thoughts. From back by the door with my eager smile, a good boy, an obedient boy, I could see what he was thinking. I've got no juice anyway. I can't say yes or no to anything. He had given us the tour. That was what he had to offer. His smile was pre-apologetic. Soon she would find out, this pretty lady from Peachtree Management Systems who had dropped from the sky into his little life, that he had no juice. We'd chosen him well. My eyes flitted to the four corners of the room one by one. Nothing. Not that a camera couldn't be small, of course, buried in the plaster, screwed into the lights, but nothing that I could see.
All I ask is that you answer one question,
said Martha.
And it's a darn easy question, too.
Okay.
This question is like, you know...
She palmed her forehead.
Duh.
Okay,
Mr. Newell laughed.
Sure, I get you.
So here's the question. What is it that y'all are selling here?
Newell puffed out his cheeks, opened his hands.
Cotton. Cotton goods,
he said tentatively, shyly, like a kid getting a trick played on him. Waited to see if that was right, then tried again.
Brand,
he fumbled for the buzzword.
A lifestyle.
No, sir,
said Martha, shaking her head slowly, exuding confidence. I could have applauded.
What you are selling is time.
She launched into it then. Good and confident, the whole music man business, while I made my comprehensive survey of his office, moving only my eyes. 2-spot filing cabinets, a floor-to-ceiling tiered bookshelf lined with binders and regulatory manuals, a sturdy industrial desk with a metal frame and a glass top with 3 pictures arranged neatly. Mrs. Newell, Mr. and Mrs., Mr. and Mrs. in a handsome chocolate lab. Hidden from view, not visible, but certainly present, was the fingerprint danger button. On the underside of the desk, most likely. Under the seat of the chair, second choice. Behind and to the right of where Newell sat was a single interior door. Not to any kind of executive washroom, surely. Our Mr. Newell wasn't pulling those kind of perks. A closet, more likely. Storage. While I crawled through his tidy junior executive's lair with my eyes, Martha was giving it to Maddie with both barrels.
You got yourself 4,232 folks out there,
pausing just barely, a quick sly acknowledgement that she had the figure. She'd done her homework.
And it's their time that you are selling. Every hour of good work they give to the company, every darn minute of it, that is the product. Now let's say we take one person bound to labor,
she said,
and pop him anywhere on the flowchart, okay? He's splitting open bales, he's a loom operator, doesn't matter. He's top level, he's a trustee, he's punching code on a pattern maker, okay?
Okay.
Let's say he works 1 hour. How many minutes are in that hour?
Newell hesitated. He knew there was some smart answer here, but he couldn't figure it.
60.
No, sir,
said Martha, said Jane Reynolds, saleswoman of the year.
Maybe it's 50, maybe 30, maybe 100. It all depends on what's going on in that man's head, what's going on with that man's body. What we sell at Peachtree, what we do, is we sell minutes. With our system of incentives and corrections, we add minutes to the hours that your PBLs are putting in. And you know what that does?
He was afraid to answer. Afraid to be wrong.
It makes better clothes?
It makes money, Mr. Newell.
She spread her hands.
It makes more money.
Newell chortled.
Well, we sure hope so.
For a surreal half a moment, I became excited at the prospect of making a sale. Mrs. Reynolds and I would return to the office in Birmingham and report on our success, log it in the system, get high fives from the other sales teams, arrange a meeting with the tech guys for follow-up. Jane Reynolds would be employee of the month. I'd get... what? What reward would a freedman associate receive? Alternate universes, other worlds.
I'll tell you what,
said Martha.
I'll show you. Can I show you?
Sure,
said Mr. Newell. He stood up as though maybe she was going to lead him somewhere.
Show me.
Albert?
I popped out of the back corner like a jack-in-the-box.
Yes, ma'am.
Can we get set up, please?
She said it with mild irritation, like she couldn't believe I hadn't done it already.
I saw the small look she gave to Newell, the small look he gave back, these people. I opened the bag, opened up the laptop, and pressed a few buttons. Newell scurried out of my way, stood awkwardly in his own office, hands behind his back, ponytail jutting out over his pink neck.
"Okay,"
said Martha.
"Away we go. Albert, would you mind hitting the lights for us?"
"They're just there,"
said Newell and pointed, and I hopped over to the light switch.
"What I'm going to show you,"
said Martha, calling up the first slide, the logo for Peachtree clipped off their website, and beaming it onto the window shade of Newell's office.
"If you'll bear with me, it's just a taste of the proprietary technology that Peachtree is offering, just a sense of it, so..."
The slide blinked off, and no second one came.
"What?"
said Martha in the darkness.
"Albert?"
"What is it?"
said Newell. "Oh, dear," I said.
"Oh, boy."
"Albert,"
her voice transformed, sharp as broken glass.
"Albert, would you be so kind as to turn on the lights, please?"
I did, and fast. Martha was standing, flustered, with her hands on her hips. Newell was bemused, uncertain.
"Mrs. Reynolds? Jane? Is everything okay?"
"Yes, of course, Mr. Newell."
"Maddie, please."
"Maddie, it's just, you know, they send me out here to do this, and they don't send me with equipment that actually functions, or
It was the sole flaw in her performance, the only half a moment's hesitation. Jane Reynolds would have said nigger, of course.
"A helper who can do his darn job."
Newell didn't notice her skipped beat. He wasn't noticing anything but a chance to be some kind of man. He was rushing around from behind his little desk. He was handing her tissues.
I do understand, believe me.
"Here, Miss Reynolds."
"Jane," she said.
"Jane."
Maddie Newell was smiling weakly with a dim, hopeful light in his eyes. Martha took the proffered tissues and blotted tears from the corner of her eyes. Real tears. I almost laughed. I was still standing back by the light switch just inside the door, invisible and quiet. But Jesus Christ, she was good at this.
"I have a very good presentation,"
she pointed to the laptop.
"I mean it. That is an excellent presentation."
What she was doing was, she was letting it be his idea. She was walking him along, holding his hand tightly enough to lead him, loosely enough for him to be unaware of it. She was an absolute natural. Or maybe all women could do that to all men if they wanted to.
"I would actually love to just do it alone, just the two of us."
And she gave that quick, simple, business-like sentence. "I would actually love to just do it alone, just the two of us." Just enough backspin. Just enough.
"I'll tell you what, Jane,"
said poor, dumb Newell.
"Let's head up to the cafeteria, and I'll buy you some lunch, okay? We'll have some lunch, and you can tell me what you got to tell me. Don't have to fuss around with all the tech and all that. You just lay it out for me, and we shall discuss it. Would that be all right?"
Her look of abject gratitude, Newell the savior, Newell the gentleman, was a thing of wonder.
"Oh, Maddie, that would be so kind of you. And we really do have a remarkable product."
"Of course," he said. "And I'd sure like a chance to hear about it."
He stood up. She closed the laptop, which we had loaded with exactly one slide, and followed him to the door.
"Oh, wait,"
she said, glancing at me for just one half a second, just a quarter second to make sure that this was still our play. I nodded, a degree of head tilt well below Newell's notice, and Jane Reynolds said,
"Is there somewhere my boy can wait?"
"Oh,"
Newell stopped, flummoxed. I do believe the man had genuinely forgotten that I was in the room.
"Well, he can wait right here, as a matter of fact. This door locked behind me, and it won't open until we come back. That all right with you?"
He wasn't asking me, of course. Jane Reynolds said that it would be just fine with her, and he guided her with a hand on her back out into the hallway. I waited 5 minutes after the door shut. I stood perfectly still and counted, 300 seconds. While I was counting, I stood as Jane Reynolds would expect to find her boy standing, in the corner with my head lowered, touching nothing, like a powered-down robot. At 300, I sprang into motion, and the beautiful new music appeared in my head, the wild rhythms from the lawyer's basement. It kicked up in me loud, so as I got to work, it was with the urgency of that music. I moved through that small office like a drum roll, like an ascending scale. I rolled Newell's chair over to the bookshelf and stood on the seat and ran my finger along the topmost row of binders. Dust. Same with the second level, and so on down to the floor. Dust, dust, dust.
All the thick binders and regulatory volumes, so much set dressing. I rolled the chair back to the desk. I already knew where this was going. I knew I would end up having to get into Newell's computer. This was the 21st century. Any kind of important document, anything that mattered, would be on the hard drive or on the server. But I did not want to be hacking if I could help it. So I was praying for a break here. I was hoping like crazy. I tugged open the narrow door of the desk, rifled past the stapler and the scissors, then I ducked over to the filing cabinet while I bent a paperclip into a twist. Martha and I had agreed on 25 minutes. 15 minutes in Newell's office to get the two pieces of information we were after, one for me and one for her, plus a 5-minute margin on either end. 9 minutes had already passed, 5 minutes of silent counting and 4 minutes of work as I threaded the tip of the paperclip into the chintzy lock of the filing cabinet. I felt as I had at St. Anselm's Catholic Promise 7 days ago now, Thursday to Thursday and a lifetime in the past. Break into a building, crack a desk. These were the easy assignments, the small projects outside of thought or contemplation, beyond regret or conscience. A hard deadline, a specific task. I twisted, caught the hook of the child's play mechanism, twisted again and felt it give. The music played, jumping, triumphant in my head. There were 5 drawers to the filing cabinet. I worked from the top to the bottom. Purchase orders, record keeping, maintenance logs. One thick folder with the details of 100 different trucks and trailers. My forefinger ran along the spines of hanging folders, 45 seconds per drawer. Pull open, quick examination, push it closed. Accident reports, insurance documents, vehicle registrations. The bottom drawer was financials, purchase orders and invoices, summaries of fuel expenditures quarter by quarter, reports on cost for overall fleet maintenance. Buried on the bottom of the bottommost drawer, hidden beneath the thickness of the hanging files, was a curled bundle of papers wrapped in a rubber band. What I was looking for would not be hidden, but I reached for this rolled-up sheaf anyway, tugged it up from its hiding place. It was a manuscript, typeset, dog-eared, with nervous doodles around the edges. "I Love You Too, Sir, A Tale of Forbidden Romance by Matthew R. Newell." "Jesus Christ, Maddie," I muttered and slipped it back where it had been. Jesus fucking Christ. I turned back to the desk and moved Newell's mouse to make the computer blink out of its standby sleep. I cracked my knuckles. I did not sit. I hovered over the desk, back bent, and got to it. Once, in Chicago, someone had slipped me the URL for the U.S. Marshals Service open cases page. I sat in horror in a library carrel, blocking the screen with my body, blocking from the world the sight of my own 5-year-old photo. Is that what I look like? I remember thinking. I clicked on the thumbnail picture to make it large. Those eyes. Those eyes. I drew back from the picture of myself on that screen as if from a picture of the devil himself. Had that really been me? My knowledge of computers, my ability to hack a database, to punch through firewalls, all that came later. That was all Bridges people. 4 months of training in Arizona, plenty of that time in dark rooms, navigating databases, penetrating secure servers, learning to follow the traces of men across the internet. I didn't have to breach any firewalls to get to sweet, dumb Matty Newell's desktop, because he'd written his passwords in scratchy pencil on the back of the picture of himself with his wife and his dog. I trawled his hard drive, I entered search terms, I refined them, I found a spreadsheet, living on his desktop but cloned on an internet server called Contract Drivers Database, updated most recently, 10 days ago. The truck drivers were identified here with 4-character codes, and from Angie at Whole Wide World Logistics, I had HR-59. And now I was able to give HR-59 a name. William Smith. William Smith. I stopped, staring at the screen, my hands at rest on either side of the keyboard. The clock on the upper right corner of Newell's screen gave me 9 more minutes. There was no phone number listed for William Smith, no email, no evident means of communication whatsoever. I stared at the name, feeling time slip out from under me, hearing the mad acceleration of the music in my head, wondering how many fucking William Smiths there had to be in the state of Alabama. How many Willies and Billies and Bills were we talking about in the Birmingham metro area alone? In lieu of a phone number for Mr. Smith, was a 6-digit number that had to be a driver's license number. And after a couple of slashes, more indecipherable coding, FWH9B8. Numbers and letters. William fucking Smith. I made a fist and pounded it down onto the desk, and the computer jumped and shivered. Easy, Victor. Easy, brother. Easy now. If I couldn't find my man, I could find Martha's. Fulfill my other responsibility. The other reason I was here. I memorized William Smith's tangle of identifying numbers and closed out the spreadsheet, tunneled back into the hard drive, typing furiously, breathing hard. I had 7.5 more minutes, and it took me just 3 of them to find what Martha had been prepared to drop almost $30,000 on, the infamous Torchlight database. Every person in bondage all across the floor, the 3 million listed by service name, by PIN, by marks and scars, all organized and straightforward and user-friendly. Here he was. Here was Samson. Martha's love and Lionel's father. The man and his fate in black and white on the screen before me. I hovered there, hunched forward, eyes wide, frozen for a minute's contemplation. "Well, damn it," I said quietly. I read it again, as simple a story as it was, preparing myself to explain it to her. This is what she wanted to know, and now she would know. Worst-case scenario. 2 beeps from the hallway. I jerked my head toward the door as it slowly pushed open. 3 minutes early. There was no hiding. I had no weapon. I made my hands into fists as the door came open and saw Newell in the doorway, his loafers on the carpet, his big belly, his thick right hand frozen on the handle. His eyes wide with confusion, trying to make sense of what he could see. A black man upright at his desk, fingers on the keys of the keyboard. To Mr. Newell, I might as well have been an ape or a horse, upright and clacking away. Martha was in the shadow behind him, still in the hallway, eyes flashing, pleading apology. I held him as long as I...
"What?"
he said.
"What on earth are you doing?"
"Stay," I said, hard and flat. "Stay." But Newell followed some ridiculous manful instinct and put his body in front of Martha's, protecting his guest from the one-man slave uprising in his office. But Martha, thinking quickly herself, had stepped into the room and closed the door behind her. She made a gun of 2 fingers and jammed them into his back, and Newell fell immediately for the oldest trick in the goddamn book. He stuck his hands up in the air.
"My God,"
he said to her.
"You're..."
A pink flush came into his thick neck. His eyes were wet with confusion.
"Are you a part of this? What is this?"
Martha didn't answer. I kept talking to Newell as though he were an obedient school. "Step forward slowly," I said. "Your arms raised." He obeyed. He raised his hands higher, bending his poorly tailored sport coat out of shape, tugging the hem of his dress shirt out of his waistband.
"Just, I never did anything to hurt any Negro," he said. "I never did."
Sincerely, he said it, believing it. "Get down on your knees. Lace your hands behind your head." He lowered himself down. A series of ungainly motions. A fat, scared, graceless man trying to move unthreateningly. Down on his knees, Mr. Newell risked a longing glance at his desk, at the panic button, at the telephone. He knew that he was dead. He had known for all his life in that dire, dark, late-night, fearful part of his bourgeois brain that this moment was coming. Was always coming. This was the terror that was the underside of mastery. He worked in a multi-million-dollar company, economy as big as Rhode Island, built on the backs of black people kept in cages. And so there had to be a reason they were in cages. It couldn't just be because their suffering sowed the cotton seeds and ran the bundling machines. How could it be so? It had to be because under their skin, under the smiles GGSI had painted on their faces, they were monsters. Now here at last, the moment had come. I stared down at him, just me, no weapon in my hand, and he literally trembled, his moon cheeks and the thickness of his neck quivering. "Listen, Matt," I said, calm as calm could be. "What does FWH mean?" Newell blinked.
"What?"
He was sweating, a heavy sweat on his forehead like a glaze. Martha looked from him to me, from me to him. "FWH," I said. "It's an abbreviation from your roster of contract drivers. Please tell me what it means."
It's free white housing,"
his voice quivering like a ribbon.
"That's our white people. They live here. FWH just means that's where they live."
He was here. The truck driver. Working white William fucking Smith lived here. I got down closer to Mr. Newell, down on my heels. I made my eyes wide and clenched my teeth. I was not going to kill Matty Newell, but his fear was of value. I used it as a gun, as $100 bill as the bent end of a paperclip to spring open a lock. FWH-9, I said. B-8.
Free White Housing, Area 9, Unit B-8. It's like an apartment complex. I don't know.
Any reason a slave would go there?
Go where?
To Free White Housing.
Yes, I mean, yes, not usually, but yes, niggas, I'm sorry.